So today we have the pleasure to have a talk from Professor Danny Lorling, who is a native of Oxford itself, and he's gotten back here 2 years ago, and is now a professor in the Department of Geography. And Danny has written quite extensively on inequality, housing, health, education, employment in the UK, and he's gonna give us a talk today that looks at exclusion and inclusion in Oxford itself. So thank you very much, Danny, and just...
Great, that's fine. I'll probably talk for about 30 or 40 minutes, hopefully more like 30. I'll try and do that, because I'm most interested in what you're gonna say. I don't mind being interrupted, so please, if you're very annoyed by something, interrupt me as I go along rather than store it up and be very angry later. It's quite a personal talk because this is a city I think I know the best, although I've only lived in it now for 20 years of my life, most of those years as a child. This is a fascinating city. I think it is the city in Europe with the greatest educational divides between people's life chances, for instance, at GCSE results and so on. I think Oxford in many ways is extreme. People always try to claim that their city is extreme and their city has really big divides. This is very common in Britain. When you turn up in a new city, somebody says, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor in this city is one of the worst there is. British cities all tend to have steep social divides, but Oxford is kind of special and has been special for a long time. It's a city of walls. I won't go into the history of the reason why the walls are so high and the gratings are all there, but it's worth your while looking into it if you're new to the city, because essentially lots of people used to kill each other very, very often in the last 400 years in this place, because there's a dislike about how the university worked and what it did to the town and what the town did and backwards. Now, before I go any further, I want to get an idea of who I'm talking to. So, if you arrived in the last 12 months, can you put your hand up? Any small? Last 24 months? Last 3 years? Last 5 years? Great. Last 10 years? Okay, and then who else have we got then? Brilliant. So I can't make it all up, because some of you know more than I do. That's good. It's a city of migrants. I should say quite a lot about inclusion first. Oxford has a remarkable number of people who were born outside of the United Kingdom living in it. I won't try and give you a number because Oxford is not an easy city to enumerate. It depends whether the census is held in term time or not in term time and who fills it in. But it is very high. People often talk about places like Leicester and Birmingham, London changing. Actually, Oxford's changing in some ways faster than them. And the most interesting thing isn't the proportion of people born abroad who live here. The increase between censuses in that proportion is going up faster than it's ever gone up before. So you're potentially looking at a very cosmopolitan European city here. It could, in some ways it already is like that, in some ways, if it doesn't hold, this really is going to be a city of people mixing. But it's also a city in which it is very hard to get into, not just into the education system, but just into in general. And it's a place that really likes to chuck people out quite quickly. So there are an enormous number of very temporary contracts here. Our school teachers, high proportion of our school teachers are very young. And after a few years discovered that, you know, you want to do something other than eat and pay the rent. And as a school teacher, given the cost of housing in Oxford, you can only eat and pay the rent. There we are at about 150,000 people. Could well be higher than that. Quite big in the county. But as a proportion of jobs, Oxford is even bigger. So what you're seeing is a lot of commuting coming into Oxford. It's about, I think, as much as 40,000 people a day are driving over the Greenbelt in a very green way. A very short history of Oxford. Almost nothing here, 1750. We go on and on about how ancient all these things are, but there was basically a few monasteries in effect. 1830, somebody will correct me for the exact date, but there was an exact date when the Dons were allowed to say they actually had sex. Before that date, they had to pretend they weren't having sex. After that date, you were allowed to have sex, you could get married. And so you built houses up the Woodstock and Banbury Road for the Dons and their servants, and the expansion begins. 1900, the population of the city has doubled. Actually, it's becoming a city in many ways, rather than the collection of monasteries. That's what I call monasteries. I know they weren't, but these were all, you had to be religious to be allowed to work here. 1939, you've got the car factory expanding, and you've got Oxford becoming a Midlands industrial city as well. 1970, the last of the building, Greater Leeds, but also other extensions. Barton had been added before 1970, but it appears. Then I left. I was born in 1968. I go in 1986. I go a little bit round other parts of the world, mainly other parts of Britain. Everywhere I go, people are building things, building houses. This includes in the north of England. Come back and find that nobody's built anything. Absolutely remarkable. There's a tiny bit of Greater Leeds being built for 2001, nothing by 2011. There was a year in which only four houses were built. We now have West Barton, or Barton Park, being built here, and a tiny northern extension being built there. Something's happened to fossilise Oxford quite recently, and that is part of the reason why this is now the most expensive city in the UK to live in. House prices are 15 times average incomes. In London, they're about 14, because people are paid more in London. In London, there still are places you can find just. It's very, very hard, but there are places. The equivalent to the bottom end of Barking and Dagenham for Oxford is Birmingham. So you end up living in Birmingham and commuting in, because of the way the Greenbelt works. Here's Barton Park, or West Barton, which you can see being built now if you go along the Ring Road. You see there's trees being chopped down. I love the way they put butterflies on it. It was supposed to be, I think, originally half affordable housing, probably actually affordable in original plans. It's now much less. The bulk of what's affordable will be 80% of market prices, that of course isn't affordable. Small, maybe 50 houses, I think, will still be at cheaper rents, but it's tiny as a development. Most importantly, the saddest thing about it as yet is there is no bridge over the Ring Road. There is a bridge further up from Cutterslow over the Ring Road. Oxford has built bridges in the last few years. There's a lovely bridge in Pembroke College, that just allows the undergraduates not to have to mix with whoever's in the alley waiting to leave. There's another little bridge that helps the boys from Magdalen School get to their cricket ground slightly more easily. There are various bridges have been built in this city, but apparently we can't afford a bridge here. And these are the kind of things that get me a bit annoyed about what is and what has been happening to the city more recently. This is a 1927 plan for Oxford. It's a lovely detailed document. They got some things wrong in 1927. They thought that the floodplains were that narrow. The floodplain has in effect been getting larger and larger and larger. I think we're very near to getting the £40 or £50 million to allow us to build a flood relief river down here, so we can send the water really fast to Reading to really flood Reading quickly. Reading will then pass it on, they'll build something, and we'll take out West London, which could be entertaining. But Oxford has this natural green belt within it, which I think it's very fortunate to have. You could, of course, build houses on stilts. In the Netherlands, they have ways of dealing with this, and it's not that hard to go over and have a look if you want to know what they do. But the most important thing about the 1927 plan, I'm only showing you part of it, it's circular. It was circular because back in 1927, I mean not even 1927, back in 1977, most people didn't have cars. So when I was growing up in Oxford, I can remember waiting for the men who cycled four abreast of the car works from here down to here, waiting just there for a break in the cycle traffic so I could get to school. I remembered that because a few years ago I was in Whitehall going to the Cabinet Office, and I had to again wait for people cycling four abreast, now middle class civil servants, in London to actually cross the road. I thought, where have I seen that before? But you build a circular city because travel time and distance to the middle matters if people are on foot or on a bike or using public transport. Because of the building of the car factory down here, the nature of the city changed. There was a great deal of antipathy between the university and the city. The city becomes Labour, though it varies at various times. And part of Oxford decides it really doesn't want to become a Midlands industrial city and puts the brake on the expansion. And the county also doesn't want to become a red county. I think this is part of the divides in Oxford. So the building is here, it's going on at the moment. You could easily build to here. You've got to ask why you have a golf course over here within a mile and a half of the centre and so on. But I'll talk about all of that later, over what might happen to Oxford in the future. We are about the third or fourth highest cycling city in the country, but we are slowly losing out to other places. It does make a lot of sense, I think, when you've got a medieval city not designed for a car, to try to think of better ways of organising it that don't exclude people. Exclusion and Oxford, and different orders and who is up and who is down. This kind of, I think, runs through Oxford's blood, and this is just an example using children's authors from or near to Oxford. Wind in the Willows wasn't about Oxford, it's about further up the Thames, I think, although he went to St Edmund's School. But the whole idea that you have the loyal badger and Toad's okay, or even though he's a bit annoying and he drives his car too fast, and you have those horrible stoats and weasels that you must keep under order, and if you don't control the stoats and the weasels, you never know what's going to happen. That is the kind of attitude that a young man going to that particular school off the Woodstock Road, whatever it was, 150 years ago, you can see what's in his head when he's writing about that. C.S. Lewis, who was in Cambridge for some time, but had his house up in Risinghurst at the bottom of Shotover, had a garden. I didn't know at the time. We broke into this garden when I was a boy. It was a nature reserve at this point. It had a series of lakes and a lamppost. I thought we were in Narnia. It's C.S. Lewis. You can go there without breaking in now. Anyway, C.S. Lewis, obviously concerned with many things that are religious, but it's worth thinking, why would you write a story about four children, the boys who wear ties and they go to boarding school, but they're the ones set to rule over this kingdom of animals? And again, lower orders, although in their place and being well behaved. Alice in Wonderland is about all another kind of thing that I won't go into, but again, animals. Tolkien lived up in Headington. And again, if you think about the desolation of the Shire, what was happening in Oxford at the time he was writing about that? They were building Barton, which wasn't too far away from old Headington, where he was. So you have a domination of traditional children's stories in Oxford, affected by Oxford authors. It's changed recently. Philip Pullman, in The Dark Materials, is telling you a very different story. When you have children climbing over the roofs of what are, in fact, colleges, and your heroes are on boats on the canal, you can see the beginnings of different stories being told. A huge number of people now live on boats on the canal. Middle class, upper middle class people. This image was used to illustrate this series. This is a classic image of people, I think, having swimming pools in a luxury apartment in South America in the slums nearby, and there's a wall. But you don't need to use this image. You can find an image far nearer to home. The image that really should be the first thing I think people are taught about in Oxford when they come is the Cutteslowe Wall. It's a bit unfair because most of the walls, of course, are within the town, and the walls around the colleges serving exactly the same purpose as the Cutteslowe Wall. The Cutteslowe Wall was built in the 1930s, in 1934, to divide the council estate from the private estate in Custer. There's a little blue plaque, there are two walls, so you can go and see them, where the wall was. Very rough and ready wall, about 8-9 feet high, with spikes on it so sharp they would kill a child trying to climb over. Really is a sign of division, but also of angst at a time when people were actually coming together. Inequalities within Oxford nationally had been falling for about 15 years by this point. So if you'd got yourself here, it wasn't just that you didn't want them coming in there. There was a sense that the order was changing. There are other walls around the country. York has a few. And some of them, the stubs of the walls are left so that cars can't actually cross over. But Oxford had those too. This is a picture, I used this at the end of a lecture a couple of years ago, that's why it says that. There's the original wall. This is 1959. Not the first attempt to knock the wall down. The Canadian tank driver during the Second World War actually drove his tank through the wall. He was so incensed, but it was rebuilt. Finally knocked down in 1939, so the children from the estate could actually get to the school without having to go all the way round. Now, those walls are pretty brutal. The walls we have here really are not so much serving as walls. Now we have signs saying, you know, come in during certain hours if you're a tourist. It's not so much the physical walls that are working anymore. We still have walls, but they are increasingly invisible. They work in other ways. You don't have to build a physical wall. The equivalent of this wall, which is almost in the same place, and I'm careful about saying this because I don't want to upset people in Oxford, because I do come here and my kids go to school here. But if you want to go to the secondary school that these children went to, which was the secondary modern, bottom end secondary modern school, now called The Charwell, used to be called Charwell when I was growing up here, but it's now called The Charwell. If you want to go to The Charwell at age 16, you have to get 4 A's and 4 B's at GCSE. That is the equivalent of beginning to turn it into a grammar school. The grammar school used to be down in Littlemore, very near to where the school which ranks the lowest for the state schools in Oxford are. But if you bring in a 4A and 4B entry requirement for the secondary, it's the children there who are not going to get 4A's and 4B's. And what people say, and this is why I feel the walls are rising again, is they say, but you know, we specialise in the academic children. You know, they'd be better off going down there. And they say, it's not cynical. I actually feel that this is somehow valid. But it is the Cuttlerslow estate and the Northway estate which will be excluded by, and are being excluded by, this particular behaviour. The gaps between the state schools in Oxford were roughly about £100,000 in house prices. That gap's narrowed thanks to gentrification, thanks to us. I'm a gentrifier. I came back 2 years ago. I might have grown up here, but the four people I came with didn't. So they've all displaced people who could have otherwise been in the city. Gentrification in this city is absolutely incredible. Barton is gentrifying, Rose Hill is gentrifying, Florence Park is gentrifying. I suspect you're beginning to see the start of Blackbird Leaves gentrifying. If you want to get a free bed ex council with space on the side of it, in Blackbird Leaves, that's 350,000 now, which tells you it's gentrifying, because who can afford 350,000? The smart money might even be that there is scope for a railway station there, because there's a line for taking. So once you've got a railway station on the edge of Blackbird Leaves, you're talking 1 hour and 10 minutes into Marylebone, which means Harley Street. The new station, which has just opened at the north of the city, is 1 hour to Harley Street. So kind of like Oxford's seen nothing yet in terms of what is about to happen to it. Okay, where I come from. Born here, looks very posh. Mum and Dad had to leave here to go here because here was a red light district. And this is the bottom end of Jericho. Now £800,000 for a two bed. a good size ex brothel will cost you more than that because at the size of it. Might even have a cachet. But anyway, that's where I started off. 6 years here, next to Cowley Centre. £400 for a house. And then, because there were more of us, I'll show you who there were in a minute. Not many bigger houses apart from there in Oxford. We end up moving next to that roundabout, the Greenland roundabout, next to Barton. And so from the age of 6 to 18, that's where I grew up. That's where my prejudices are formed. I learned quite a lot from being there. This map, by the way, is well worth looking at. If you just Google CASA, C-A-S-I, Booth map, you'll find this detailed map for the entire country, which colours in areas from green to red, depending on the extent of deprivation in them by the government's official measure. Whenever in the Russell Group universities I've worked in, I've got students to do this, they've all very routinely, 95% of them, have been surprised to find they come from a green area, surrounded by green areas. That's just the way that Britain works. The roundabout's unusual because it's got all the colours around it, which tends not to happen so much. It happens more in London than it does elsewhere. That's me and my brothers. I was the shy one at the back. The other three far more extrovert than I was. We're a mixed race family. My two brothers who were mixed race, their fathers were born in Barbados, which is relevant for something I'll show you in a minute. But that's why we ended up moving to where there was a house that could cope with six people. And I was fairly posh. My dad was a doctor. That put me then in the 1%. We had a telephone line. We eventually had two cars, the Mini and the Metro. And these kind of things were unusual to have. And I had parents who had been to university. Not any old university. They've been to this university. I've got grandparents who've been to this university. I've got cousins who've been to this university. But I didn't go to it. On the subway, going to Cheney School from where I lived, somebody had graffitied that little sign ages ago. And I always think, when you're doing academic studies about areas, it's very interesting how much people actually just know themselves that we tend to discover. I was just having lunch with somebody, and we were talking about how it can be odd. If you move, okay, I'll call it more progressive, you might call it more left, but over my life I may have moved in this particular direction, and you find yourself often in academia with people thinking you're a little bit odd, you go and do those talks to Marxists and so on, you're strange. When I came back to Oxford and met people who I'd been to school with again, who'd managed to survive in the city, which is a minority, they didn't think my views were odd. Because they weren't high up in society. So people in normal jobs in this city know that people above them shaft them, to put it. And I was telling them, oh, I've done this book, I've done that. And they go, yeah, but that's obvious. Why have you written that? It's not obvious to people in the universities, and it's not obvious to people in the elite of British society. I'll show you a bit about schools and jobs and income in a minute. We have a JSA unemployment rate in the county of only about 0.5%. It's incredibly low. Uh-huh. 0.5%.
Can you repeat that?
Jobs, about 0.5% of the potential workforce are claiming job seekers' allowance of Oxfordshire. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you can't stay here if you can't hold on to a job. It's a city that exports people when anything goes wrong. If you declare yourself statutory homeless and you've got a child, odds on you'll be offered somewhere to live in Birmingham by the City Council, because they simply don't have the accommodation to offer you. So Oxford is continuously exporting people who fall on hard times. This includes the middle and upper middle class. It's falling ill, it's splitting up your relationship. The cost of the city is so much that if you split up, the two families that you will become cannot afford to live here, so you have to go, and losing your job will not all not managing to get another temporary contract. But at the same time as I talk about all these bad things, I do think it is good that we are becoming such a European city. It is very interesting. It makes the referendum really dangerous for Oxford. I was told that a third of our income to the social sciences division comes from the European Union, from the European Science Foundation. And I was just trying to think, what do I do as a senior member of staff in this division in 2 years' time if we've suddenly lost a third of our income? What on earth happens to Oxford, given how many migrants come here? It would solve the housing problem. It would solve the housing price problem. I've put this up here just because the connections are too good to be true, if you like. We're in somewhere which was partly funded on the back of plantations in Barbados. And if you've got two brothers whose fathers were born in Barbados and have grown up in the city, you can see the connections. And I was thinking of the scope of it. You could never pay the reparations to the number of people who were actually descended from the people whose labour was used to build this place. Even if you just made the reparations £50 or £100, there are too many people now to ever pay. So if you're ever going to pay back for what's been done, you've got to do it through hard work and producing something useful. You can't do that. If you go around the university, you will see many sites where some rich family have donated many millions to allow something to be built. And I always think what's interesting when you look at that is what a tiny proportion of their profits it is that's actually come here. And just how much profit had to be made outside of the rest of the world to tart up a stone wall somewhere in Oxford. There is a kind of story about this side of Oxford and philanthropy and wealth that will be told at some point. Just a few more maps. I may have broken my rule. Just 5 more minutes and then I'll end. There's fascinating histories to thing in the city. This is a map that somebody found left on their doorstep in Grand Point. And somebody may know who produced it. It's a map of who went to fight in the First World War and who died. So you get a red dot if somebody went to fight in the First World War and died, and you get a blue dot if somebody went to the First World War, a man in all cases, and survived. And there's the map of Grand Point. This is just, that's Folly Bridge. This is Carfax just up here, so you're looking south. And if you've got good eyesight on the amazing £30,000 screen you've got in front of you, you can see that the blue dots are much more common in the terraced houses, and the clusters of red dots are more common. And in the villas, the bigger semi-detached, there were fewer people who actually went. I very much suspect whoever drew that map didn't draw it to make that point. But I do think it's interesting to see these kind of patterns in this city.
Can I just tell you something about
that? Where that comes from?
I do know who did it.
Okay.
And just to say that there's a whole exhibition about that in the Oxford Library at the moment.
Great, thank you. That's a very good introduction.
I'll give you the...
Because literally you can see somebody's just taken a photo of it on their phone and sent it to me, which is very nice to see. I mean, it's worth saying something about provisions between the city and the university. The university is at the top of the social hierarchy of Oxford. This university, Oxford Brookes, has changed its position remarkably from when it was the Poly, which was somewhere you could actually go to university if you grew up here. We are now a black hole. We don't have a university in Oxford. From the point of view of government measures as to whether you have a university you can go to. Once you've got AAB as the minimum entry to many courses at Brookes, then for 95% of the children of this county, they've actually got to go out to go to university. I know this from a study that was done about 10 years ago, trying to identify places where universities should be built, and identified Lincoln before and so on. And Oxford's actually identified as a place that needs a university for the local people. Our third university, by the way, is Ruskin College. Which is now up in Old Headington, and I think could serve a useful purpose. The gaps between us in the city are extremely wide because it is the most elite university in the UK. It's more elite than Cambridge in terms of producing prime ministers and so on. until very recently, the university was not paying living wage. The university now pays living wage. Almost every college pays it. I'd love it if somebody can tell me which the last couple who won't pay it until George Osborne brings it in. I mean, it's going to be quite remarkable. But anyway, but even when you're paying the living wage, to the people who are paid the least in this university, who are cleaning the rooms and so on, they are mainly living in the poorest part of town, which is the part which has the school which does worse. And why does the school do worse? It is not the genes of the people who are there, because the genes actually turn over at an incredible rate. It's not the same people who are there anymore. It's because mum cannot afford to buy you a second-hand computer because somebody hasn't paid her enough money to have 500 quid spare at the end of the year. If you don't have a second-hand computer, you're not going to get 4 A's and 4 B's at your GCSEs nowadays. It's kind of as simple as that. The university does endless interventions to parts of Oxford to try to help, but it simply just needs to pay people that it employs a little bit more to make those kind of things better. And possibly not pay people at the top quite as much, which is part of the reason why the house prices are high. But it's also because somebody built the M40 and they connected us to London. It's also because those dons were allowed to have sex at that particular point. And because they're allowed to have sex at that particular point, they built the big houses in North Oxford. Unlike Cambridge, which hasn't built the North big houses, the big houses are attractive to people who are high up in the BBC and high up in other things in government and to hedge fund managers and so on. And because they can move to the big houses, when they can now outbid anybody in university for them, you have the most incredible cluster of independent schools. This then further reinforces the rise in house prices. Cambridge, in contrast, has incredible state schools, partly, but still has big divisions, but partly because of a lack of large houses that people with money from London might want to live in. That's my daughter's hand. I've forgotten why she's there. And now it's going to tell me it doesn't want to go any further. Let's see if we can get you a couple of maps and then stop. These come from Mark Fansham, who produces for the City Council. He did a brilliant series of maps, and his latest map, the one on house costs in Oxford, actually got onto the BBC last night with Mark Easton. Mm-hmm. I thought that was quite a good accolade. The baby producing areas of Oxford are in blue. This is where the babies are largely produced. The sought-after elite state primaries here have problems getting enough children. They keep very quiet about it, but you can easily get your kids into St Barnabas and fill in gyms nowadays, because nobody with small children can afford to live there. But you try and get your kids into Marston primaries, let alone elsewhere. This is where the babies are being produced. And just to show you a few social class maps of Oxford. Oh no, first of all, life expectancy difference. It's small. It's only 8 or 6 years. It should be at least 15 years for a town of this size. It's 20-year gap between similar areas in Sheffield. There's a 20-year gap in London. It's small because it's very, very hard to stay here in the poorest parts of the city. So people in the poorest parts of the city are now actually healthier than they should otherwise be. It's also possibly narrowed. My dad always believed this, because people who live here drink enough claret to reduce. liver disease we're quite good at in North Oxford. But there's the difference in life expectancy. There's the students. You'll know about this set of students. They're also the people who use the most electricity and gas per head, and it's partly because the buildings are old. That's this tiny bit of venturing up the Cowley Road. When you talk to students about the Cowley Road, they mean this bit, not this bit or this bit. And this is Brooks taking over that suburb. People in the bottom three social classes by the ONS classification. You can see the concentration now mainly in Blackbird Leas, no longer concentrated as much as it was in the other estates, and a little bit of Rose Hill that's just going to go. 2 years ago, I went to the seminar that all new staff get invited to. Do you know that one at the start of September? And people put their hands up, about 200 members of staff, and the standard complaint is, how on earth are we going to afford to live here, which is fair enough. I didn't have the guts to say 2 years ago, and I'm quite glad I didn't, say, comrades, if we all quietly move into Rose Hill now, we can have it. anybody else notices. I think it's too late to do that now. And very unfair to people who are trying to just survive in the city. The poshest areas are the brown areas. You can see Grand Point's now got posh. That's how the Iffley Road's gone posh. The Botley Road, despite the fact it's flooding, has gone posh. Always was posh here. Headington's got posher. And this area has got posher. So it's quite remarkable to find that you can't live in the places that you grew up. And access to London matters more now. So that when this part is built, I very much expect it'll very rapidly become too expensive for most people to live in, because you can get to London so easily. That's just another map putting them all together. People claiming second home discount because it's not their main home. We do have quite a lot of property which is underused in the city. But we really don't have that much property. There isn't that much empty property in Oxford. And here's my last slide, just to stir things up a little bit. This is a map of Oxford. It's taken from a pamphlet produced by the people who won the Wolfson Prize last year. The Wolfson Prize is a prize for trying to suggest ways in which you could expand the city. And the city obviously was Oxford, although they didn't name it. Here's the suggestion that in the future we have a tram route here, possibly going off here. We have a tram route here. We may well have light rail here. If you're a long-term resident, you're looking very carefully to see if it goes near your house. That's what I did.
What is the green line?
The green line is potentially light rail. This may all seem ridiculous to you, but one lovely thing about having gone away from the city for 30 years is it's slightly like being a Time Lord. I came back in a TARDIS. Cornmarket used to have bus wars in it. They pedestrianised it. People said that could never happen. The city was covered in cycle lanes. I know the cyclists of Oxford get really annoyed when I say this because they're so upset about how bad the cycle lanes are. And there's a new deadly one on the way from the station that's worth watching out for. But compared to what Oxford, you know, I only ever cycled around Oxford. I couldn't drive. Lots of things have got better in the city. It will change again in 30 years. Even for those 30 years of such little change, there were changes. These blue circles are suggestions for secondary school sized expansions. These are 5,000 households. It's the size you need for a new secondary school. This is within that 1927 plan. The other blue dots are ones I added, saying, well, why not there? Just because the Rothschilds own the land doesn't mean you can't have one there. Why not some here? It's a golf course. You know, people could actually view. This isn't Whiteham Woods, it's nearby, but again, it was in. And that wood down there, the St John's own, is, I don't think has any species of biodiversity or interest in it whatsoever. But I just put those on there to stir this thing up. Oxford's going to go in one of two ways. It's either going to carry on fossilising and become a little bit like Windsor with Eton, where you can't really touch Windsor and Eton and do much. Or it will break out of this straitjacket that it's in at the moment, which is more green. The idea is to avoid 40,000 people driving over a green belt. If it doesn't expand, then the exclusion of people who can't afford to be here is going to get worse and worse. Increasingly, your academic staff are going to have to arrive with family money, which means, again, you are recruiting from a minor aristocracy again to be able to stay. Things are going to get worse. So Oxford's got to choose between becoming a more divided city or a more inclusive European city with lots of people on bikes and ever so green. At the moment, the power is not to do anything. It's taken me 2 years to work out that the status quo really is not to do very much, partly because the people with power are the ones who've managed to stay here for 10 years and you kind of get used to it. We have 7 protected views of Oxford that can't be touched. At least 4 of them, there's one on the top of Balls Hill, at least 4 of them, the trees have grown so high there is no view to see anymore. What I can't understand is why we don't put ever so well built housing with very little car parking space where you could actually get a view of the Dreaming Spires, because there's hardly anywhere where you can see them. And part of the kind of housing we need is retirement apartments, no stairs, on the flat, for people who are currently living in Oxford in three or four, occasionally four bedroom houses, who are staying here because they don't want to go to Newcastle to retire. They want to stay near to their friends. There's a lot that could be done in the city. The university itself is aware of its own problem. The university doesn't think that the problem for school teachers or social workers or nurses is its problem. And I think the university needs to begin to realise it's part of something bigger, but I can understand why universities find things complicated and difficult to handle, because people in universities are no more clever than anybody else. That's the end of my spiel. Please pick me up on something that you find particularly annoying, or ask me why I didn't talk to you about urban theory and the well, and the wonderful papers geographers have written on gentrification recently. It's just that you can experience it and do it yourself here.
Well. I'm another Daniel Sharp. I'm just filling in an anecdote. I went to the Polytechnic, Oxford Polytechnic, with three C's in town planning, and I was the highest qualified entrant amongst the 30 that got in that year.
Yeah.
That's 1971.
Yeah.
Two plugs. One, Lynn Hanley. The walls, yeah, she described, she grew up in the housing estate, the wood in Birmingham, yeah, the biggest housing estate at the time, council housing estate, and the wall is in her mind. And she's never managed to pierce the wall. She's having to live with it, and cope with it, and adapt to it. And the other plug is, I'm running a course, What Are the Planners Ever Done For Us? And it starts tomorrow at the Hatch, which is 37 Little Clarendon Street. It's going for 6 weeks. It's 2 hours from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock. I can't say you'd all be welcome. We have to expand into the street, but any number of you who want to see me afterwards, I'll hang around. So Wednesday nights for the next 6 weeks, we'll talk about how the planners have maybe caused some of these problems and how they might ameliorate some of them.
Okay. Peter Hedgegaard from Oxford Brookes Planning. I think one thing you didn't mention you might have done is who has the political power as far as the planning and development element of what you're saying is talking about. I mean, yes, the Green Belt is a national designation, but the people who exercise the control over the land around the city, as you actually obviously know from a planning viewpoint, are the councillors and the district councils that surround the Oxford City.
Yeah.
If people were left to the good councillors of Oxford City, I'm sure they would have done a lot more in terms of addressing what you've been talking about. The fact is, more so even than the university mentioned, to the people who are elected in the Wallingfords and the Thames and whatever of this world, the problems that you just described, or the issues you described for Oxford,
yeah,
are of sublime relevance. And the only far they do have relevance is in the fact that there might be some question of them encroaching on the Greenbelt, which of course is a totem and a very important, yeah, not least of course in terms of sustaining property values in the area around them. Those are the people who vote for those councils, yeah, and they know I'm not going to vote to support you.
I can see that. What I can't understand, I was in Woodstock last night, doing a talk in Woodstock in a hall, and behind me was a banner saying no to 1,500 houses in Woodstock. What I can't understand, because the county has been giving a 100,000 target, and all over there are villages complaining that they don't want houses built around their village. Why do people in Woodstock can't just say, please build 1,500 houses on the edge of Oxford, rather than just say, don't build it in Woodstock? And I've not understood that, because if at least two districts may not make the agreement they have to make, if they don't make the agreement, people like Barrett's can simply walk in and start building those little detached houses they can call executive with double garages. And we're getting close to that. So, the other thing I think...
Well, can I just say that, yeah, reply to your point is that to do what you just said, I mean, the Greenbelt is a national designation.
Hmm.
And clearly there is a lot of votes politically, not just obviously in Oxfordshire and the whole South England and elsewhere, in maintaining their notion of the Green Belt as, as an element of permanence.
It is,
therefore, it's not just aggressing a local issue, it's this...
It is tricky. But what you could do is for every acre of Green Belt you take off, Green Belt, you could add on 3 acres and increase somebody's house value miles away from Oxford and make them happy. There's one at the back.
I want to comment on something you said. Unfortunately, we live in a nation that since 2003 has been consistently bombing Arabic countries. Mm. You know, we killed 500,000 Iraqi children. And the cost of that is colossal. On top of that, in 2007, Alastair Darling borrowed in excess of £800 billion to bail out the 4 high street banks. Today, we spend £120 million a day in interest to service that debt. I want to take issue with what you said, that we can't play reparations. It seems to me like this nation is fantastic providing money to kill people. We've got four nuclear weapons which cost us $100 billion a year. And you want to sit there and say to me that we can't afford to pay reparations. You know, to me that's white supremacy. You know, whites can do something, kill people, and it's okay. They don't have to charge, they don't have to recompense for anything that they do. You know, I really think that we can pay reparations if we, the English, decide that we've done wrong and it ought to be done.
It's good. I agree with you. I wasn't trying to say we shouldn't pay reparations. It's just that if you begin to work out the amount owed to the number of people who were affected and the actual value of a building that you couldn't use for an old age pension home because the stairwells are not actually that good, it's not as... We pay reparations in a much wider way simply than money, which requires changing your behaviour. There's ways of doing it. If you take the debt, we are a debtor nation now. So we could become a bigger debtor nation, but the Office of Budget Responsibility says that the fastest way to reduce our debt is to let people in, partly because they share our debt. But it's about just changing your behaviour in general in many ways. I was just trying to make the point that this college here, if you were to divide its value out, as a boutique hotel, say, amongst everybody whose labour, the sense of everybody whose labour is used to build it, wouldn't be enough to pay back the debt that's owed. But we can talk about it more.
Just interesting your opinion on the Oxford partnership and the link between the city, the county council and the university and the Smart Oxford initiative that's emerged this summer. Just interesting your take on that, given the talk you've given, and whether some of the engagement of Smart Oxford is really addressing some of the issues you've raised.
On that, yeah. Tell us more about Smart Oxford before I. Which initiative is it?
It was one that started up over the summer, just rather than linking, recognising the council, city council and county council have had fights over the years, and the university really hasn't engaged very much in terms of the urban development of Oxford. So it's an initiative between, rather than getting the public together, sit down and create memorandums of understanding, it's individuals setting up links.
Okay, yeah.
And it's somewhat Hugh Aldridge at universities that's been sort of making these links. But it's the notion of creating Smart Oxford, and there's got a web page. I didn't know whether it's something you've seen.
I haven't come across that. I am aware that people who do things like run social services departments in the districts around Oxford are beginning to work out that they could become liable because their social service department fails and it's their fault, because of the housing problem. And I think when you get people in charge of the schools and in charge of the universities and in charge of the JR beginning to work out that they look as if they're doing a bad job because of the housing problem, they are the elite, you know, and at that point you've got more chance of something happening. And if you tag onto that the fact the roads are completely full, and as soon as the price of oil goes down, they fill up even faster. It does feel to me like we've got to a point where you have to begin to do something differently. The other immediate one is that the railway lines are about to be electrified. So you need to do something to that station very quickly before you put the electrified line in. And that's suddenly become urgent. So things are going to happen. But as it is, we've got a new shopping centre, you know.
I was just going to follow up the point about why local councillors may or may not take responsibility. because the county is responsible for education, even though they might have been elected in Wallingford, they end up, and people who are not as familiar with Oxford might not know that in 2009-2010, Oxford City had the worst Key Stage 1 results, which is up age 7, in the entire country, which is extraordinary for a city built on education. And so there is a huge responsibility for them that they must recognise. And that's, so...
It's worth remembering that because of this political divide that is implicit not just within Oxford, but it's been in Oxford as a county as a whole. Don't forget, there's not a single Oxford councillor who's on the ruling group as a county council. So if you're talking about resources, again, you know, the majority of the majority party, they're not going to say that actually, I don't know about whether he's or him is, especially when presumably they would argue they've got their work cut out defending their patch as it is, I mean, in the light of the urban cut.
Well, I think there's also an argument that the Oxford City actually lets, Oxford County Council lets Oxford City fail in terms of education. Yeah. I think they're not, they're actually... They don't, because they can blame it on migration, they can blame it on a multicultural population in East Oxford, and so what do you expect? You won't get decent school results. So I think, that sounds really cynical, but I actually think, from my experience working in the county council, they don't mind if Oxford City fails.
Well, possibly you bother too much about the scoring rate and sort of grading system, in that people do get a scientific education, and they go a long way beyond the 3 R's, which a lot of the third world and second world can only just about expect to achieve anyway. They do have that education, whether they pass or not, they are present, and they do take it in. And so for the rest of their lives, they've had this basic scientific, philosophical, political education, mathematical education, which they will use in their careers and lives. How it seems that we all just end up in a shopping queue.
Yeah, you do that. Over schools in Oxford, they're much better than they used to be, because they used to, I was taught by men who'd been demobbed from the army and just given a job at the end of the career. Teachers are much better. The kind of problems which really are undefendable is the fact that Rose Hill Primary cannot guarantee its boiler's going to work at Christmas. You know, we should be beyond that with the buildings. And the fact that some schools are losing half their staff in the summer. You know, and you can't run a school when you lose that many. I suspect part of the reason the Key Stage 1 might be so low might be the creaming off to private schools. We know that around about age 15, more than a third of the children are going private, which has an effect on... If you take a further children out of the stats of a city, then the stats will look different. The other thing that is very different between the county and the city is the county has this series of comprehensives, which are in the middle of nowhere, like Tame, where you basically can't fail, because you're going to get everybody. You've got to be really pig-headed to drive all the way from there 30 miles to somewhere else. And I think the county don't understand that one reason why their state schools do okay is simply that they have these default catchments. But Oxford needs to sort out its five state schools. They shouldn't be competing with each other. And you should get to a point that other cities have got to, where lots of parents who feel they have to send their child to a private school stop doing it. We should be able to provide schools, And it's not, the teachers are fine. The problem is so many of them, in all but the poshest comprehensive, I'm under 25, and it's great to have young teachers, but you do want some in their late 20s and 30s. And the problem with primary heads, 11 of the most recent heads, they couldn't find replacements for. So 9 had to be internal appointments who might not have necessarily wanted to become a head. Again, because of the housing problem. Yeah, one at the back.
I'm a completely statistic, but I hope it's very interesting to hear statistic in front of it. I've heard people talk about the Northern Gateway. I can just see on the top of your map.
Yeah.
I used to commute in and out and stay one night a week with people like in the top of North Oxford. And I remember being there one evening when their phone was ringing off the hook. There was clearly sort of community agitation afoot to see off this Northern Gateway, which kind of, I was commuting in that for a range of reasons, was Rye. But I wondered where it sat within what you've described in terms of does it provide more housing, the right kind of housing? Where are the centres of power? Because I'm led to believe the university is tied up in it. But I don't really understand where the university sits within planning power. It's a huge wealthy body.
Yeah.
It must have kinds of interests. I don't know where they are
articulated
to that. And where does the boundary between the county and the city operate in the context of you're talking about these satellites, effectively? And how does that boundary play out?
These are
outside different responsibilities.
These are outside the city boundary.
Okay.
But of course, central government could simply redraw the boundary at some point. It's not. There's nothing to stop that happening. It's taken me 2 years to work this out. The university is a rather ugly concrete building in Wellington Square. Okay. When something happens here, or might happen here, or whatever places, it's one of the six colleges with land. That's the key. It's just, particular colleges own land around the city, and wealthy families do as well. The problem where the Northern Gateway is going ahead is getting some housing, but the difficulty is you're looking at flood zone around there. I mean, it'll probably work, but it's east and west of the centre are off the rivers. This is what you'd normally expand into. The other thing worth saying up here, just to make the point, is the 22nd anniversary of Campsfield this November. Mm-hmm. So we have at least the campaign, the Campsfield is Europe's biggest detention centre of a city of England. If you're talking about inclusion and exclusion in Oxford, that could be housing. Why, you know, I'd say, why do you have a detention centre at all, which is detaining people who haven't been found guilty of anything? But in particular, why do you have a detention centre somewhere so near to where people are actually trying to live and work? It's a really odd thing. One of the main reason, probably, the protesters helped a great deal stopping camps have been expanded, but the fact the local residents really didn't want Kidlington to be known as Europe's biggest and doubling concentration camp for people, because it might have effect on their house prices, probably helped the local Conservative MP decide that she didn't want it either. And when your local Conservative MP decides she doesn't want it, then you don't get it. But it is odd that we're talking about expansion here and here. We're not talking expansion here, and particularly, I just want to know who owns the houses here that really stop this going on. You know, there are. I would keep the golf course in the middle of the city. You know, there's one if you want it, have a bit of green space. But you don't need a golf course here, you don't need a golf course here. And you don't want people driving on the A34. You want them living nearby. The reason I don't worry about saying this is that the amount of attention something happening on the edge of Oxford should get should mean it would be very hard to do something very terrible. But we are lucky. We're like California. We have 300,000 extra people turning up here every year, even with how, you know, draconian we are about stopping people coming in. If you've got 300,000 people extra turning up a year and you've had that going on for 15 years and you don't build housing somewhere, things are going to get tighter.
So, could you say something about council housing and social housing? Because, we're going to suffer another big loss of council housing, I think, because of the government's new policy of getting housing associations to sell their valuable properties. Just to say that, but also to say, I'm not sure the thing about the pressures not to build are only about wealthy people or not wanting it to happen. I've been doing workshops across the city with a range of people from different backgrounds and ethnic and demographic, and people love green spaces. I mean, across all backgrounds I can work out. So I don't think it's just that
simple. Golf course isn't really a green space, though, is it?
I'm not talking about the good. I'm talking about generally. Well, actually, that's quite an attractive place to walk over. So, you know, I think people
are allowed to walk in the golf course.
Ruin's a good walker.
All I'm saying is people love, a lot of people, what they love about being in a rural city or Oxford or anything is that it is rural. So you are dealing with that. It's not just about people being selfish about house prices.
You are, but you've got an enormous amount
of owning the wealthy, owning the land. I'm saying that is important.
You've got an enormous amount of green spaces, which you definitely should protect. It's, you know, I grew up here. We never went out there. I took my children recently to here, and we walked on the public footpaths in Boars Hill. People have built 8-foot-high fences either side of the public footpath. I mean, they're just asking for a housing development. I think that's a way of saying bring it on. particularly, it aggrieves me. I don't know anything about it. I just took my kids there to say, it was really exciting when I was eight. We went, you know, we climbed up this town, climbed it up, can't see Oxford. Took them on the footpath, can't see anything. There was even somebody who stuck one of those mosquito things, you know, the high-pitched noise in a public space. I mean, it isn't very welcoming. But the other side of what you're saying, in the Wolfson Prize document last year, what they had, which I thought was most innovative, and remember, this is given out by Lord Wolfson, who's a Conservative, and he gave him £150,000 for winning. They suggested a whole series of country parks as well, which are green spaces in Oxfordshire, where you'd be allowed to go and walk. And I'm amazed that nobody who owns the land in the country parks has noticed that's in the suggestion, and it will be very hard to get. And it might sound fanciful. Remember, I've just spent 10 years living in Sheffield, where we had an entire national park you could walk out to from the city. And if it's possible there, the idea that you cannot, and all you do is you simply designate the right to roam, and the landowner has to make sure that the fences are good enough and the stiles are nice, otherwise they're sued for not making the stile good enough for you to walk over their land. Mm-hmm. That's what the right to roam actually achieved before. You could have country parks in Oxfordshire, so you're not just going to Minster, Lovell and Christmas Common.
Mm-hmm. Council housing and rent controls. I mean, we don't have control over that locally, which is very much control, but...
Well, there's all kinds of... I think things are going to go badly wrong with housing at some point, not too far away, and we'll have to do a lot of... the legislation that built Milton Keynes is still in the books. If you wanted to build using Newtown legislation, you could. But I think our property is massively overvalued and something's going to go wrong. The election wasn't predicted. The election result wasn't predicted. 15% rises in property at the moment. It really is. If you're trying to get a Tokyo-style crash, this is the way to go about it. And then if you really want to do it, you get the prices going up 50% this year, 50% next year. And then you give people a vote on whether they want to stop people migrating into the country and then see what will happen to the housing market. I mean, you can work it out. I suspect people will vote to stay in Europe because they'll work out what's going to happen to the house prices. But we're going to spend 15-16 months talking about how upset we are with some people who live with us. And this is going to start getting very uncomfortable. You've been waiting ages.
Yes,
you?
Okay. You just mentioned Milton Keynes, and one of the things that I believe would help our housing and job and transport system would be a proper new town. Completely separate from Oxford and probably from Bicester as well, sort of up north somewhere. Now, and you have to face the problems because the landowners will all say are. But it would be preferable to clamping 1,500 onto Woodstock, in my book. Now, what I wanted to ask you about, is it possible to do calculations about these new transport potential lines, the purple, the red, the green, and presumably the blue is another kind of special.
That's a tram.
As well.
That's a tram going up London Road.
And how much transport they would actually carry, and how much that would make sense to the whole of Oxford.
Yeah.
Because public transport that runs now has reached capacity and hasn't got curbside to extend it in St Aldate's. And if anybody builds another housing estate, I think they must be batty, let alone the shopping experience.
The shopping experience. We've reached bus saturation. So you stand at Carfax or just further down, and you can take visitors, I do this, and board them, and you can stand there and just watch the buses going nose to tail. Trams have greater capacity. Trams also have a magic ability that middle class people will step onto them. shouldn't worry us, but it is useful. We had them in Sheffield for ages. There's a whole series of cities in Britain where you can look at them, but our twin city Grenoble has trams. So you can work out that the capacity is much greater. You then don't have the worst road in Oxford is now the London Road. When two buses are crossing each other at speed on London Road and you're on a bike, you're in trouble. Much better than it used to be in Oxford, I have to say. But you would reduce the number of buses dramatically, you would reduce cars dramatically, but you'd have a public transport system that meant that it was easier and easier. You still have to let people get around by car because some people have to be in a car and some people want to be in a car. You just want the car to be the slowest mode of transport to help encourage you not to go that way, because there's no way cars can transport the bulk of people. This is 30 years away.
Do the two councils, the councillors of the two councils, take on board what you've said about reaching bus capacity?
And no.
No, well, this is, seems to me to be, you know, we're sitting there while Rome burns, actually, fiddling away. We know that it's reached bus capacity. Yeah. And they are just, you know, developing this more and more of that and more of the other.
But they don't, so I shouldn't go on too long because you need to. Yeah. They don't until you hit a crisis, so that cars were not put out of corn markets until it got ridiculous.
Yeah.
The sad thing about Oxford is things have to get really bad before something is done about something. But something is eventually done about things. My big worry is that we become Windsor.
Yes.
Although even becoming Windsor would be a slight achievement, because I like this city and there's lots of good things, but Windsor at least knows how to make money out of its tourists. You know, we have them come in for a day, we let them in for free, or if you're Magdalen, you get some teas off them, and if you're Christchurch and you've got Harry Potter, you charge them a bit. We're going to get a lot more tourists, tourism's increasing worldwide, and we haven't thought about how to get an income from the tourists, and the income from the tourists could pay for the upkeep of things. And if you could pay for the upkeep of things from the tourists, you don't have to go to extremely rich people with dodgy industrial backgrounds asking for money.
Exciting.
Which is what we currently have to do, and it's a steady income. But there's lots of, I don't know, I'm far too opinionated, but you walk into a place you've grown up in 2 years ago and some things seem to be a bit of a mess. Should we just do one more question and then stop? Go on.
I was curious on your thoughts in relation to the electoral boundary reform and the fact that Blackbird Leas will technically be removed from the city and added to Henley.
Okay. this is a good political one to end on. The county has six constituencies. One is the equivalent of a Durham Pit Village. That's this one. 50% Labour vote now. Labour vote rose at last two elections. Partly a personal vote for the sitting MP, who won't probably be the MP next time. This is a bit marginal, Oxford West and Abingdon. The other four are not marginal at all. The key thing for Oxfordshire is if people register to vote now on electoral roll, and that's the private renters of Oxford, which are the biggest group, and then the students, if they register to vote now, when the snapshot is taken at the end of November or December, that electoral roll will be used to determine the new constituencies, not the current one. If they will register, we get seven constituencies and not six. If you've got seven constituencies, there's no way you can cut up this Durham Pit Village and not end up with two Labour seats. Mm. It's really interesting. So if you want to get two Labour seats rather than one, you have to get people to register to vote, not to use their vote. They won't be here in 2020. They won't even be here when it comes to the referendum. But they will be providing representation for somebody who will be here. That's quite a hard argument to get over, which is why the Momentum group, which are the Jeremy Corbyn group, are trying to do it. Now, the other much more complicated thing, I'm being cheeky because I know I've got any questions, is the other thing you need to do, because this city has an amazing number of very nice Greens in it, and doesn't have an obvious seat for the Greens, is that the Labour Party need to work out, I'm not a member of either of these parties, but they need to work out four or five seats to hand to the Greens to say, please travel out during election time from Oxfordshire and go to Stowe or wherever it is, because you can't ask the Greens to shut up and let you win in the place. This happened in Chester in 2015. The Greens did not put up a candidate in Chester. Labour won it by about 90 votes on an anti-fracking motion. This is possible. It also happened in Sheffield Hallam, where I lived. The Conservatives walked out of Sheffield Hallam, which is the only reason that Nick Clegg still got elected. And those kind of political things, it's the same old battle of the stoats and the weasels, really, in a way. It's just that the stoats and the weasels are the Greens and the Reds, and they need to talk to each other better than they do. And a lot of this is also in the interests of Toad at Toad Hall as well. It's just that Toad doesn't get it yet. Thank you very much.